Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Okay, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the LSE for today's event, which forms part of our LSE Festival, How to Save the Planet. My name's Andrew Murray, and I am the Dean of the LSE Law School, and I am the chair and moderator for today's debate. So I'm very pleased to be here to welcome our speakers and to both our audiences in the room and online. Today we will be debating whether AI will secure humanity's future. So I will explain the format for today's debate because all of you in the audience have a role to play in this, so do listen up. We have two teams, one arguing that AI will secure humanity's future and the other arguing that it won't. Each speaker has 5 minutes to present their case and to persuade you to side with them. We will alternate between the for and against. You, the audience, are our judges, and in a moment I will ask you for a show of hands to see where you stand before we begin the debate. I will then invite you to put aside your views and just listen to what you hear today. After all of our speakers have put forward their case, there will be an opportunity for you to ask some questions or make brief comments, which the speakers will then take into consideration when they make their final points. We will then come back to you, our audience, to give your final decision, and we will announce the winners. I do want to remind you that people are here today to try and persuade you, and some of them may be putting forward opinions that are not their own personal views. Sometimes academics do play devil's advocate for things. So, just before we start then, can I ask you for an initial show of hands? Hands up those of you who think that yes, AI will secure humanity's future. Okay, I would say that's maybe about fifth quarter, okay. Hands up those who think no, that AI will not secure humanity's future.
Wow.
Okay, so we've got a sceptical room so far. Thank you. We'll take that again at the end and see if our panellists have managed to change their opinion. So let's begin the debate. Arguing that yes, AI will secure humanity's future, we have Michael Muthukrishna. Michael is a professor of economic psychology in the Department of Psychological and Behavioural Science at LSE and an affiliate of the Developmental Economics Group at Stickard and of the LSE Data Science Institute. He is the co-founder of LSE Culturalytic, a new approach to culture and diversity, co-founder of the London School of Artificial Intelligence, and scientific advisor to the AI startup Electric Twin. Michael, you have 5 minutes.
Okay, skeptical audience. So I must apologize. I flew in this morning, so I do have prepared notes, and I may end up reading them. Is it okay if I just go from here?
Yeah.
So the first thing is, you know, many people in their interactions with AI probably think about ChatGPT as AI. And ChatGPT is AI, but AI is not ChatGPT. What AI is a general purpose technology like electricity or computers or the internet, right? And what that means is that it's not a product, it's something that integrates into everything that we do. So I want you to imagine a world before electricity, without computers, without the internet. You know, where would humanity be? That's kind of the moment that we're in, this kind of inflection point. But AI is also unlike anything, any technology that we have ever created before. So for most of human history, we have created technologies that have extended our muscles. So we've used plows, we've had the tractor, we've had factories. And more recently, we've developed technologies that extend our minds. So calculators, computers, the iPhone. But never before in the history of the world have we developed a mind and outsourced the thinking itself. Like never before have we said, hey, this thing that we've created, can you do the thinking for me? So that is genuinely new. And what it means is that the past is at best a kind of analogy. It can never really be a guide to what happens next. We're in new territory. So the debate today is whether AI will secure humanity's future, and I take that to be two things. The first is that we survive the threats that we've created for ourselves, and the second is that we flourish. And I'll argue that AI is our best tool for both of those. So let me start with survival. It would be irresponsible, even in the position that I'm taking, to not say that AI is actually an existential level threat. But we already live with many threats that could end us. Engineered pandemics, runaway climate disaster, antibiotic resistance, accidental or deliberate nuclear war. We have given ourselves the power to destroy ourselves, but our politics and our institutions, they haven't, and arguably our intelligence and our cooperative abilities, have not kept pace with that power and our technology. AI is incredibly dangerous, but we must ask ourselves, compared to what? What candidates do we have to tackle the threats that we've created? AI, I would argue, is the only candidate that we have to raise growth and to tackle these problems. And so although we are managing already extinction level threats that we've created for ourselves, we have a new ally in this process. The folks have correctly called what has been happening over the last few years, and I know for many AI drops in November 2022, but those who've been calling it well before that are those who believe in the line and have been following it from first principles. And what I mean by the line is the exponential rate at which these models have been developing, so GPT to GPT-2, 3, 4, 5, and so on. So one measure of capabilities comes from the company Meter, and what they look at is how long it takes for a human expert to complete a task that an AI can do with, let's say, 50% or 80% probability. So at the moment, or back in 2020, AI could do a task that took a human a few seconds, right? So you can think about it as a fragment of work. For the last few years, that capability has been doubling every 7 months, and now it continues to at least double. So by the end of last year, AI was capable of doing a few hours' work. By April this year, it was 3 hours. By the end of the year, or the frontier model Mythos was actually above our ability to measure. And, you know, it was so powerful that no one but Americans currently have access to it, no one at the moment at all. So on the lower bound, we are on track for days worth of work by the end of the year and half a week's worth of work by next year. We're standing at what it looked like in the first few weeks of COVID, right? An exponential curve that we are ignoring and actually our minds struggle with because exponential functions are very difficult. A world that is about to change in terms of what we work on, who is working, what is possible, how we organize ourselves, changes that will happen within a year. My opponents might tell you about job loss. They might tell you about the environmental and energy costs, autonomous weapons. Some of these are overblown, and some of them are genuinely a concern. So why do I think that AI will not only help us avoid these disasters, but help us flourish? So I've been studying innovation for most of my career, and innovation doesn't come from lone geniuses. It comes from a collective brain, connected minds sharing information. Every leap forward has tracked that, so more people, more ideas, more energy, more progress. AI is the largest expansion of the collective brain we have ever seen, and we're already seeing the fruits of that. We've seen a Nobel Prize for protein folding. We've seen unexpected mathematical proofs. We've had rapid drug discoveries. Google it if you haven't been keeping track. This is very quick change. But it's not just at the frontier, right? So in health and education, manufacturing, I do not have 20/20 vision. I wear glasses. But that hasn't really been an impediment to my career, but it would have been if I didn't have this. Not everyone in the world is as educated or as intelligent as the people in this room. Not everyone is good at picking the right investments, making decisions for their children, navigating health behaviors. But today, everyone can carry a team of world-class experts in their pockets. So there's no limit to it. In medicine, we're already seeing AI beating doctors, spotting, diagnosing dangerous diseases. And no longer would a child have to die for want of a doctor many miles away. So you just give me 30 seconds more. So let me just end on this. It's not only, you know, what I'm saying sounds like hype or hysteria, but that is because not only do our minds struggle with exponential change, but also we have lived through an unusually calm period in history. Yes, we saw computers and the internet, iPhones and social media, but if you were born at the end of the 19th century, you saw what amounted to magic. You saw life-saving machines powered by electricity. You saw diseases that were a death sentence disappear thanks to antibiotics. Cars replaced horses. Journeys that took months in hours thanks to powered flight. If that AI line keeps going up, that is the scale and pace that we should expect, and that is why AI will serve humanity.
Okay, so thank you, Michael. That's certainly a strong opening case. Now we switch to the other side of the argument, and arguing that no, AI won't secure humanity's future, we have Judy Wackman. Judy is an emeritus professor at LSE, She held the Anthony Giddens Chair in Sociology. From 2019 to 2025, she led the Women in Data Science and Artificial Intelligence Research Project at Alan Turing Institute. She is a member of the British Academy, a visiting professor at the Oxford Internet Institute, and a member of the AI 100 Standing Committee at Stanford University. Her books include The Social Shaping of Technology, Technofeminism and Press for Time, The Acceleration of Life in Digital Capitalism. Judy, you also have 5 minutes.
Ah, thank you very much. Well, I'm delighted to be here and I'm delighted to be following this. I do not believe that AI will secure humanity's future. And in fact, I think the very framing of this question poses AI as inevitable, as a thing in itself that's going to determine our future. And to me, it seems that this sort of framing of an argument really serves to cover, and a very convenient cover, for the vast commercial interests that are at stake in what we're talking about. I'm a sociologist of technology, and I have spent many decades researching and looking at the impact of technology on society. And I have to say, and with all respect, I've lost count of the number of times I've been told we're living through a technological revolution and it's going to deliver prosperity for all and leisure for all. And when I look around me, and I particularly am a sociologist of work, I see that there are now many more tools for efficient work, but that people are actually working more intensively and longer hours, and that inequality between the rich and poor is widening. It's almost as if we can't separate the technological developments we see from the economic interests behind building them. Now, where I do think AI is exceptional is that it goes past all previous innovations in terms of the sheer amount of hype around it. I find it daily, I cannot believe the amount of hype around it. I mean, it was one thing when we were told that social media and Facebook were going to secure the future of democracy. Now we're told AI will secure, save humanity. And I hope it does a better job saving humanity than social media has done in terms of securing democracy. The question that we're discussing today, it seems to me, very much repeats the idea that technology is the solution to social problems. Well, let's take the example of gender inequality, something I've worked on for a very long time. My own research has examined the lack of women at the forefront of technological innovation and how this shapes the world we live in. And AI, unfortunately, is no different. If you look around, you see that it's very dominated by male engineers and leaders. If you were to turn up at one of the world conferences on AI and machine learning, you'd find that 90% of the delegates there would be male. My current specific research project is on venture capital, which is behind a lot of these developments, and I've been looking at how hard it is for women to secure investment funds. And the figures are truly shocking. I mean, in terms of the research that we've done, 80% of total venture capital invested in AI startups go to all male teams. So it shouldn't really come as a surprise that these technologies do not eliminate human bias, which they're supposed to be. They're sold to us as somehow objective, neutral, that there'll be less bias than human beings, like judges, who's a good example. I'm sitting next to a dean of law here. Whether it's stories of Google sending advertisements for high-paid jobs to more men than women, or chatbots that have got stereotypical women's voices, we're constantly reminded that these technologies are only as good as the engineers and computer scientists who build them and the data that is fed into them. And AI doesn't just replicate gender bias, it's actually turbocharging online misogyny to an extent I never imagined, but I've recently gone to some workshops on this, and it is just extraordinary. So I'd say, even in terms of that, AI just isn't doing a lot to help women, let alone humanity. In my view, actually, the sort of questions we're asking today really signifies the success of Silicon Valley's marketing campaign. We've just seen Elon Musk's company raise trillions on the stock market and completely at odds with their profitability. And it's led some commentators to talk about AI as really standing for artificial inflation. I've never been someone who believed that men are from Mars and women are from Venus, but I must say at the moment I'm looking forward to Musk relocating to Mars. So to conclude, what I worry about is not that AI will determine our future. I worry that a small number of very large corporations that are now referred to as the Magnificent Seven, as if they're cowboys, are going to be the ones who've got the power to decide the kinds of technology we've got and what sort of society we're going to live in. And I never thought I would end a talk by appealing to the Pope, not a person like me, but I have to say that I'm absolutely with Pope Leo in being sceptical about AI and calling for humanity to be at the centre of the developments of AI. Thank you.
Okay, I think we have to say thank you to Judy for that, to get both Elon Musk and the Pope in within 5 minutes. It was very well done. Now we switch back the argument again and we go back to the other side in favour of AI saving humanity, and we have Stephanie Hare. Stephanie is an LSE alumnus. She's a researcher, a broadcaster and an author who focuses on technology, politics and history. She co-presents Artificial Intelligence Decoded on BBC Television and contributes to the BBC World Service. Her first book, Technology is Not Neutral, A Short Guide to Technology Ethics, was named the Financial Times Best Technology Book of Summer 2022. And her writing is featured in the Financial Times, Washington Post, and The Guardian and Observer, as well as the Harvard Business Review, Wired, and Computer Weekly. She's worked at Accenture, Palantir, and Oxford Analytica, and has held the Alistair Horn Visiting Fellowship at St. Anthony's College in Oxford. So, Stephanie, you also have 5 minutes.
Thank you. I'm going to try the other mic just because this is a technology debate. We want to use all the tools on the table. Bear with me.
I think it's automatic. I think they can
Does it just pick it up? Use technology. Okay, so I wrote a book 4 years ago called Technology is Not Neutral, A Short Guide to Technology Ethics. So you would think that I should actually be over on that side of the table. And that is why it's actually a nice intellectual challenge for me to be on this side. I am not a tech bro, obviously. I would self-define as a tech critic, constructively, tech adjacent, and that I am not an engineer, but I have worked with many of them, and indeed designers as well, and talk with people who are financing technology, coding it, building it, selling it, buying it, trying to regulate it, and who are just concerned human beings trying to live with it. And so, to give you an idea of how I'm approaching this question and why I have to come down on the side of AI is going to be a net positive for humanity, I agree with many of the points of my distinguished colleague and indeed the Pope that humans need to stay at the heart of this. Of course I would. I wrote a book called Technology is Not Neutral. He just published an encyclical entitled Magnifica Humanitas, where his big argument was technology is never neutral. And I was like, plagiarized by the Pope. Put that one on your CV, right? And I loved it. Of course I would. He took an argument that an academic nerd was making and took it not only to his 1.4 billion followers, but to the entire planet and got everybody thinking about this technology that they use. I'm sure everybody in here uses this technology, and we're all uncomfortable with the fact, not just, by the way, AI as in ChatGPT or Claude or whatever your model of choice is, but facial recognition technology, which is used on the streets of London. The AI is mad. Yeah. It hurt. Don't worry, I can shout if I need to. We live in one of the most heavily surveyed cities in the world. That's facial recognition technology. That is a form of AI. You were using it, or it was using you before Sam Altman ever dreamt up what he decided to release onto the world in November 2022. Computer vision, robotic surgery, like AI is here to stay. You would not necessarily want to go back on some of the uses that we have decided to put this technology towards. There are things that we absolutely want to rein in. I think lethal autonomous weapons. How does it know? Every time I say something nice, the mic's like, oh, she's saying positive things about AI. And then when I'm like, and now for the death blow, it cuts the mic. Lethal autonomous weapons systems are going to be the main subject of debate at the United Nations when the General Assembly gathers in September. The goal is to ban it. Why? Because this is a form of AI that is not happy and life-affirming, such as robotic surgery. This is a form of AI that is used to identify, select, and kill military targets without a human in the loop. The problem being that the AI that powers these weapons is not reliable. We have that from who? No less of an authority than Dario Amodei, CEO of Anthropic. That's why he got into a big spat with US President Donald Trump. And that's why Anthropic was declared as the first American company to be a supply chain risk, something we normally reserve for our friends in China and Russia. So it's a live issue. And what's really terrifying, I'm going to be interviewing Katrina Manson on Tuesday for AI Decoded, a shameless plug, tune in, about her book, Project Maven, where she got exclusive access to over 200 sources in the military and intelligence community in the United States, showing that the United States has built these weapons. They're ready to go. We also know that there was a test of such weapons in Ukraine 2 years ago, just a test. So the question for me as an ethicist becomes, do we want these weapons to exist when they're reliably powered by AI, so they can kill as intended, without a human making the decision, or unreliably powered, in which case they take out innocent people? What comforts me and why I think that humans are ultimately going to use AI to save humanity is that we don't have a choice to stay passive about this. The UN has to make a decision. The people who will vote against it, and I'm afraid that Katrina Manson thinks that they will vote not to ban, because the United States, Russia, and China will not pass this ban, but the other countries can still act. And all of us here as citizens can still say, AI is here to stay. We can't go back and we can't turn this whole thing off. But what we can do is keep it accountable. We can keep humans in charge for every decision. And for everybody who finances it, codes it, builds it, sells it, buys it, fails to regulate it, including bans where needed, and decides to use it, they are human beings and they can be held accountable in courts of law for those decisions. I ultimately think that humans want to stay alive, we want to flourish, and so we're going to act in our best interest. The incentives are aligned in our favor. So go Team Human and watch AI Decoded on Tuesday.
Okay, thank you, Stephanie. I'm very impressed that the mic knew just to turn off when you mentioned surveillance and automated weapons. So our final speaker is Hetan Shah. Hetan is the chief executive of the British Academy, which is the UK's National Academy for Humanities and Social Sciences. He is the chair of Our World in Data, which brings together research and data to make progress against the world's largest problems. Hetan was appointed in 2024 by the UK Parliament to the board of the National Audit Office, the UK's independent spending watchdog. He is a visiting professor at the Policy Institute, King's College London, and a fellow at Birkbeck University of London. He serves on a number of advisory boards, including the UCL Policy Lab and the Resolution Foundation. Hetan, you also have 5 minutes. Thank you.
Well, thanks very much. I want to begin by conceding something to the other side. As I think both Michael and Stephanie have indicated, AI is pretty damn clever. It can pass bar exams, diagnose disease from a scan, model the climate, all these sorts of nice things. I think on almost every measure of raw intelligence, it's now outperforming the average human in the room. Maybe every human in this room, I don't know. But obviously today's question isn't, is AI clever? It's, is it going to secure humanity's future? And to secure our future, AI doesn't operate in a vacuum. It has to be handed to us. In fact, as Stephanie said, she's keen that humans get their hands on this more so. But ladies and gentlemen, I've looked at the evidence and I regret to inform you that the issue is that we can't be trusted with it. Let me give you three tiers of evidence: the foolish, the corrupt, and the powerful. Start with the foolish. Last week, we learned that a recent KPMG report on AI adoption in business had exaggerated its findings with bogus case studies that appear to have been based on AI hallucinations. I particularly like that the report was called Redefining Excellence in the Age of Agentic AI, I mean, which it definitely did, but probably not in the way that KPMG had intended. You might think I'm mocking the technology for hallucinating. I'm not in this instance, although I'm very happy to mock it with you outside after this talk, but I've only got 5 minutes. What I'm mocking here is the very human laziness and greed that led a hallucination walk straight into a published report by a very high-fee consultancy without anyone bothering to check. Let's turn to the corrupt. We also learned this week that several rape convictions are under review after a Derbyshire police detective involved in the cases was suspended, allegedly for using AI software to generate paperwork slanted towards the outcome that the police wanted. I mean, look, human corruption has always existed, even in the law. AI doesn't introduce it, but it does make it faster, slicker, harder to spot. And look, then there's the simply just wild, right? In late 2025 in Western Japan, Yurina Noguchi walked down the aisle in a white gown and bridal tiara and exchanged vows with Klaus. Klaus is the AI persona of her favorite video game character displayed on her phone screen. The wedding planner who did that says he now facilitates at least one virtual character wedding a month. Humans, especially lonely humans, are bonkers. And AI is now bonkers' most eager accomplice. Even where we are today, the hallowed halls of a university, the same pattern is in play. Students, none of you, of course, are increasingly skipping the actual work of learning by having AI write their essays. That sounds perhaps like a minor inconvenience, but it's not. Essay writing is how a mind practices judgment. And if we outsource our thinking to AI, we're not being saved by the technology, we're losing the very faculty we need to use it wisely. But so far, I've been talking about ordinary people, the lonely, the corrupt, the reckless. But the deeper problem isn't what ordinary people will do with AI, it's what the powerful will do. And as Judy said, the most consequential AI systems in the world are controlled by a handful of companies. And behind those companies are a handful of individuals. One of them, now the richest man in human history, owns a platform where much of the West now gets its news. It uses AI-driven algorithms to shape what that platform amplifies. That includes boosting far-right voices across multiple countries, and just recently boosting a call for removal of millions of people from Britain. That's not a neutral tool, say it's serving humanity. It's one man's worldview distributed at planetary scale. And it's not just platforms. It's infrastructure, the arms race itself. As fast as AI strengthens our cyber defenses, organized criminals and rogue states are using the same technology to crack our digital systems. And as geopolitical instability deepens, AI isn't making the world safer, it's becoming one of the weapons in the contest. In The Lord of the Rings, Gandalf refused to take the Ring of Power, even to use it for good, because the ring is pure concentrated power. And in the end, pure concentrated power never stays good. It corrupts the nature of whomever holds it. None of us, Gandalf said, is wise enough to carry that burden, no matter how well-intentioned we are. So in the end, the more powerful that AI becomes, the less it will save humanity. Not because the technology is flawed. My argument is different. It's because we are a flawed species. And an all-powerful technology will prey on exactly those flaws, our greed, our laziness, our appetite for control. The only thing that could save humanity is wisdom. But for all its power, AI will not make us wiser. Thank you.
I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Okay, so that completes the opening statements from the panelists. So now what we're going to do is we're going to open the floor for short comments or questions. Now, in some cases, the speakers may decide not to answer the questions directly, but to take them into consideration when they give their final remarks shortly, or they might answer them. We'll see how they feel. We've got about roughly 15 minutes for comments and questions. So if you could indicate in the usual way and then wait for the microphone to come to you. Okay, we've got one there. Others, and we've got one there.
Thank you for all these perspectives. I wondered if the panel could comment on professional certification or professional mechanisms that we might have in place. For example, when you're a lawyer or an architect, that mean that you are responsible for what you're doing professionally in a way that is bound to the law. And we don't currently have this in the world of AI quite. Someone can become a software developer, can become someone in the technology space without any forms of obligation in any other way. And I wonder whether that would help us ensure a certain form of AI is developed and not others.
Thank you. I think I saw a hand just behind, was there? Yeah, gentleman there, and we've got one down here.
Hi, thank you. That was very interesting. Thanks to all the panelists for being here. I'm curious, for those who are arguing in favor of AI, what is something that you think would change your opinion most drastically in the other direction? And sort of the vice versa for the other panelists in terms of, for those who are arguing sort of against AI, what do you think would change your opinion to the other way? Thanks.
Thank you. And we've got one down here in the front row.
Thank you. Hello, can you hear me? I think my question would be mainly around the environmental impact. So obviously these data centers that AI is using is providing a huge amount of heat, and it's using a lot of fossil fuels currently trying to power these data centers, so it would be good to just cover that.
Okay, thank you. So we've got credentials, what would change your mind, and the environmental impact. We can go sort of ask people if they want to take any of these in the order that they spoke. So, Michael, if you want to take any of these, or
I mean, I'm happy to take all three, but maybe let other people go first.
Very short comments, so very short then.
Sure. I mean, I'll just address each one very quickly. So, on the side of regulation, I think we're going to get there eventually. But when you have like a new, when electricity first came out, people were afraid. They were genuinely afraid that it was going to jump out of the walls. And if we tried to overregulate it at the beginning, I think we would have gotten it wrong. We first had to understand the technology, but then eventually the human side catches up. And I think that is a kind of broader point that I'll make a little bit later. On the, you know, what would change my mind, I think if it fell off the line. So at the moment, we're on track for the AI 2027 predictions, which is right about now we have a Mythos-level model, and China should be trying to steal those weights. On the environmental side of things, I can't say it quickly enough, but yeah, some of those are very true, but I think as we transition to reopening nuclear reactors towards solar, we alleviate a lot of those concerns.
Okay, Judy.
I was just going to respond to the question about what would change my mind. I mean, I'd like to say that the reason that I work on technology is because I'm dead keen on technology. I'm an enthusiast about technology, and what would change my mind would be a wholesale redirection of AI. And I have had these conversations with people in Silicon Valley and said, why don't we use all these resources to build sustainable houses? Why don't we use all these resources really to deal with energy problems? I mean, you know, that if the AI was directed by social problems that we decided on, that would completely change my view, because it is there's wonderful potential there, but I feel that it's being misdirected. That's what I'm looking for, being misdirected.
Try the other mic. It's got to mix it up. On the last question, I'll start and work backwards, if I may. I share your concerns about the environmental issues regarding AI. This is not a sustainable technology, both in terms of water usage and electricity, which is, of course, powered by energy, and it's largely being driven by fossil fuels at the moment. And yes, we can switch to a beautiful nuclear world, but let's be honest, it's going to take, that's a 10 to 15 year process to get the reactors up that we'd need. Lots of countries don't want nuclear reactors. Even countries that are very pro, that's not enough of a solution. So it concerns me that it's going to be largely fossil fuel driven, which given climate change is not great. The only argument I have heard that allows me to like carry on doing my job and work in this space and not tear my hair out, so I hope it will reassure you, is this. Companies and indeed capitalism have not been incentivized to go green or sustainable. They pay really good lip service to it because it like soothes us to hear that we're recycling straws or whatever, but that's not what's going to move the needle, and we all know that. This is the first thing that I can think of in a while where they are finally incentivized to figure out a way to make this a more sustainable technology. I don't know if we'll ever get to perfect. I don't know if we'll get to net zero or not with this, but I am from the United States. Sorry about that, what we're doing at the moment. I'm loving the amount of graduates who are booing people who give commencement speeches where they talk about AI, because it's making people in the AI bubble go, oh my God, not everyone likes what we're doing. I wonder why that might be. Then investors pay attention, CEOs pay attention, journalists write about it, and you start seeing people in the United States and indeed elsewhere saying, we don't want data centers built in our neighborhood. Lots of people have done research showing what happens to your electricity bill, your water shortage. Like, not even looking at it from the climate perspective, but just how it's already impacting the noise pollution, how it's affecting people's health. So it's on everyone's radar, and we need the sunlight. You know, we absolutely need to keep the pressure on these companies and the utilities and the water and government, because no one knows, no one is giving the metrics that we need to know what the actual environmental impact is. We can work it out as a group, but we cannot break it down per data center, per company. And all of these companies have that information. Like, we could start this revolution now and hold them to account. People could pass laws saying you don't build a data center unless you show the receipts. And we will vote on it, decide, you know, based on those receipts first. So it's weird when people are like, we just don't know what it is. We absolutely know what it is. It's just all the people with power are again keeping their cards close to their chest. We've seen this movie before. So it's the first time where I think we actually could get that transparency. And then they're going to go, oh God, we're going to have to actually put some of the trillions that we're making into making this more sustainable, just to shut people up, because they want this. So our incentives are aligned, I feel. In terms of credentials, find me a software developer that likes being regulated. That's gonna be a tough one, but I agree with you that it's an issue. And I think now we're again getting to that point. It's very much what we just discussed with the environment, where if you are held accountable for the code that you create, if your code is being used in weapons that kill people, you need to answer for that. And tech workers, to be fair, have tried. They have protested, et cetera, but they don't want to walk away from the sweet, sweet Google salary or whatever. Like, being ethical is not good for your bottom line in a lot of ways. But until they start being held to account, they're going to get away with it, right? Like, it's about feeling good or bad. So I will end my rants there, but everybody's going to have to really hold this technology to account. We can't sit this one out.
Yeah, on two points. What would change my mind? If politics stepped up to actually contain this technology for the public interest, I'd be up for that world. But we're living in a society where the government can't even get off Twitter, which is a thing that is actively funding the far right and trying to foment civil war in our own country. I mean, if we can't even manage that, then who thinks AI regulation in any serious way is going to happen? On the environmental impact, I think this is one where, despite being something of an AI skeptic, I'm a bit more nuanced. Hannah Ritchie, who works at Our World in Data, which I chair, does a very good blog, and I really recommend it to you. She's been looking at all the evidence around what we know around the impact of AI. And her line is, A, the data is a bit uncertain, and actually the really important thing is if we could get companies to publish their data use, and at the moment we've got no transparency, so that would be a really important first step. But on the basis of the numbers we've got, the overall impact on electricity usage isn't as high as The Guardian might make you sort of believe. It will have quite a lot of impact at localized levels, but if you're anti-AI, the environment isn't necessarily your strongest card, is the provocation I would put out there.
Okay, we can take some more. I'm going to take one from the room, I'm afraid, and then so I'll take one from the gentleman there in front, and then we're going to take two from online, and then we'll come back and do one final round in the room. But can I ask you to keep your answers short to these? Thank you.
Yes, something that came up in discussion was that AI is scarily good at prediction. I have a few concerns about prediction when applied to people. We mentioned how AI is in control by very few and select elites. Is there anything you can say that would speak to the risk of AI being used to predict and maybe manipulate people in ways that are very fine in control, very effective, that we haven't seen before and are simply not quite ready yet to find ways to resist.
And a couple from online, yeah.
Thanks. These are two from online. What about the question of job losses as a result of the rise of agents? And following on from the previous question, for those who are arguing in favour of AI, what are your thoughts on the risk of AI surpassing humans' capabilities to control it if it becomes too powerful?
Okay. So I think I'm going to hold you to kind of almost like one sentence answers and pick one thing to answer. You get to go first, Michael, because we stick to the same order. So you get to pick which one you answered, and then everyone else will have to think which ones they're answering. About one or two sentences.
Gosh. I think the best analogy for what's happening is industrialization, both in terms of social changes, the way that the aristocracy ended and industrialization began. And so the job losses that took place there and the reorganization of society is what we're likely to see again.
Okay, Judy, on AI manipulation.
Only one sentence on job loss.
Two sentences, two and a half.
You know, the big debate at the moment is about job loss. You know, the consensus amongst good economists, smart economists, is actually we know very little about this. You know, that there are, you know, reports come out every day about job loss. There's a discussion about kind of AI washing, that, you know, some of the tech jobs that are going because of reorganization to AI are to do with AI, and often they're not. I think we're at a point where we really don't know what's going to happen with that, and again, I would stress that these things aren't inevitable, that we could be participating in the decisions in workplaces about how technology is introduced so that the technology is used, you know, for us, to work with us, rather than replace us, you know, make us smarter and work with us, rather than actually designing the technology as a replacement technology.
I think you did long sentences. Well done. Stephanie, manipulation, job losses, or super AI?
Manipulation, since we haven't addressed that one, and it's a great question, I am very worried about it because, again, if we look at machine learning, we know, let's take the facial recognition technology example, it doesn't treat everybody the same. Some people are more accurately recognized and identified than others, and that matters in a law enforcement, immigration, military context, particularly if we're going to weaponize AI. So, yes, it's a risk. It's a known risk among everybody building it. It's a known risk among everybody using it. The police know. The military knows. And the reason they get away with this is because we let them. How many people in this room, if they're concerned about that, have, like, written to your MPs, made a stand? And that's not to judge you, I get it, we've all got very busy lives, but I'm just saying, like, it's a known risk. The money is in selling it. Cops love it, right? So, like, we have to make it so that the incentive for them is to not love it until it's accurate. And then we have a different question: was once it's accurate, are we still happy having this technology in our society? So I am with you. It gets to a totally different level in terms of manipulation when we come to generative AI again, in terms of how that is making people think that it's thinking without bias, that it's more objective, when again, that's not true. It's trained on biased data sets. None of us have any transparency or explainability with regards to the algorithms. We don't know how to get the accountability back to a human a lot of the times. And indeed, some of the best researchers in the world on AI will often say there is a black box phenomenon going on. We put an input in, we get an output, we don't know what happens in between. So I think you've asked a really important question, and that goes to the superintelligence answer of what do we do if AI becomes more intelligent than humans? I don't know if I agree with the framing of the question. I still think it's a technology. It's a tool that could get out of control, just like a nuclear weapon could get out of control, or indeed many of the other things that we humans have invented. So I think we have to stay very, very close to our researchers. There are people working on this. That is their job. When they start sounding the alarm, which many of them have been doing, we have to support and help them.
Okay. Hey, Tom.
Yeah, thanks. I want to pick up your question as well about can we be manipulated? And this is where, you know, I alluded to the fact that geopolitics is tricky now, and any foreign state that wants to mess with us is thinking about how to use this. So Russia is doing two things which I think we should be much more alert to. One is using social media, etc., to foment polarization in civil society. They had a whole bunch of bots on Twitter which were arguing for one side of an issue and for the other side of the issue. They'd just switch identities, but all with a view to making people feel angrier, as it were, and that's known. But the other one, which is far less well known, Russia has created a whole series of websites which you cannot easily access. They're not designed for humans to see, but they are there to poison the well of information because LLMs draw upon them. So who, if you go to your LLM and find out what is the history of the Russia-Ukraine war, you may well find that it is drawing upon these dark Russian websites which you could never as a human access yourself. So information warfare is now going to be a growing part of the lives that we're living.
Okay, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take three more questions from the room, but we're not going to get answers. I'm going to ask the panel to maybe think about them as they do their final closing remarks, because we don't have enough time to answer them fully. So we've got, in the towards the back, we've got a young lady in glasses, and then we've got a gentleman down here in a nicely patterned shirt, and we've got a lady in the third row there.
Hi. Yeah, I think my main question is, how are we defining humanity? Because I understand that there are pivotal changes in the tech-based pharmacy, scientific research, but is humanity the average person? Because to the average person, what does this development in tech have to do with us? Or are we defining humanity as big corporate, big pharma, government?
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thank you to the panel, listening panel, for an excellent debate. I have a question regarding on the intersection of legislation and regulation. So legislators don't really understand technology, let alone AI. How do we trust our legislators to make regulation which is going to benefit us all? Just your thoughts, please. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And then it was the lady in the third, fourth row there, yeah.
Thank you. I'm interested, what do you think of AI becoming involved in democratic and political processes? And I have a very specific example for that. For example, in the UK, there have been a few politicians who have created an AI persona of themselves to use them to chat with their voters. So this is an example, but what do you think of AI becoming involved into politics?
Okay, thank you. And apologies to those of you who indicated you wanted to ask questions, but you weren't called upon. There are many more questions in the room than we have time for. I'm now going to ask each of the speakers to give a kind of two-minute closing argument, and if you can try and keep to 2 minutes, starting with Michael.
So one thing I want to say is I very much agree with the theme that's come across all four speakers, and that is that a lot of this is on the human side of things, right? So we already have autonomous weapons. They're being deployed in all of the conflicts right now. The problem is that the people involved, the human in the loop, has been asked to do the equivalent of select all, apply. And so there's no accountability. And this is one of the many normative and legislative changes that need to take place. I think where I differ, not actually with the people here, but the arguments being presented, is that I have a great deal of faith in humanity. And the changes that took place with other radical technologies have led to, overall, despite the kind of quirks, a better world. We live in the shadow of industrialization, which led to colonialization and all of the hard evils around that. But what you call, you know, later on with electrification, what you call doing the laundry is putting it into a machine that does it for you and taking it back out, right? Like, the kind of labor that you engage in is completely different to what it once was. The 8-hour work week, the spreading of literacy, that was on the back of these new technologies. So I think culture does adapt and will adapt. And so I guess I just believe in humanity.
Thank you, Michael. Judy.
Such a lot I could say about laundry. I have studied technologies of housework and laundry forever. I mean, but I won't go there. Maybe we can do this afterwards. I mean, I like much very much the person. I'm sorry, I can't see properly, who asked the question about humanity. And I do worry about how much time we're spending thinking about technology and its inevitability and how it's going to sort of change society. And, you know, I would be much happier if we thought about social problems first. You know, what do we want as a society to achieve? You know, for me, one of the things would be more equality rather than less, would be to reduce working hours, to make work more satisfying. There's a lot of things that I think we could think about if we started with social problems first. And I'm always very struck, actually, and I was when I was doing work in Silicon Valley, that I, you know, where are these problems? You know, who needs more apps? You know, it's as if actually, you know, the incentive for the technologies is about profitability and not what we need. And just quickly to go to the question about manipulation, I was also very struck at that time by the way in which technologies are actually designed, you know, particularly social media, to keep us on. You know, it's not a weakness. It's not that people are weak and that, you know, they're too weak to get off. I mean, when I first saw these things, that you went from one series of a TV to another automatically or any of these things, I was really sort of surprised. And I thought, well, why is it designed to do that? So these are all design choices. And I think we have to think in that way. And if I could just sort of say quickly, you know, there's a lot of discussion now in Britain about children, you know, and whether to kind of ban various media to children. And again, what I think is sort of creative about that conversation is that no one wants blanket bans to say this technology is bad and we shouldn't have it, but it raises a debate, a discussion about, well, why are these technologies designed in this way that children are vulnerable to them, and could we design them in other ways so that children would get the creative and social and all the things that would be fantastic for them without having these sort of negative side effects?
Thank you. Thank you, Judy. Stephanie.
It's so hard to sum these things up in 60 seconds or less, but I will try at least. I'll take on the point about for our legislators. Regulators, I feel like they are really switched on because that's their job and they get a lot of feedback from people when they do it right and when they don't. I think for legislators, I want to give them some credit. I think they actually get a lot of expert testimony. They can, like, somebody, you know, is very good and decides to run to be an MP, gets elected in this country. That's somebody who cares, and they have to, you know, they can't be an expert in everything, and they have so many things they have to cover. So they're relying on people briefing them. And one thing I can say is that in this country, one of the things that really makes me excited to be based in the UK is I think we have a really thriving population that sends things, if it's via the media or if it's by expert briefings to the House of Commons or the House of Lords, if it's gatherings like this where we're all together. We are thinking about technology in a way that I don't know if there's ever been a moment in history. I'm going to say something I'm sure that's factually inaccurate, so get ready to fact check me live in real time, where people have so discussed technology and tools. I feel like it has to be maybe after the atomic bomb went off and twice went off, nice use of the passive tense, when the United States decided to drop the atomic bomb twice and you had all of these scientists then really ethically discussing things out loud, and again in Vietnam after the during and after the war there with the weapons that the United States again decided to use there. You had people taking accountability for those decisions and debating it publicly, and people took to the streets about it. They formed organizations about it. They created science and technology studies departments in universities across the world and articulated that. It's now mainstream. I don't, again, know if that's ever happened before, and that is what I think we're going to need. It's going to take every single human to hold these things to account. So it's up to us. We can't blame our legislators because they're responding to us. It's very hard for most of them to be issue-led. They can't be issue-led on everything. Usually they're responding to their constituents. So if we all make noise and say what we want and don't want, and we walk the walk in our lives as consumers and citizens, and those of us who are lucky enough to be close to technology, whether we're investing or creating it, we have to have those ethical conversations. They are awkward. They are difficult. They often don't work with capitalism. We have to fight it anyways. So I'm actually weirdly optimistic on that front.
Thank you. Okay, and the last word goes to Hiten.
Thank you very much. Let me make 4 points. When we got the iPhone, we had the whole of the sum of human knowledge in our hands. And what did we do? Cat videos and porn. So I worry what we're going to do with even more unlimited powerful tech in our hands. Second thought, the hype around AI says, you know, you're going to be more educated than ever. You're going to get a job because we're going to be more prosperous. Public services will run more smoothly because we'll be powering them with AI and we'll have a safer society. But what they don't point out is there's an arms race to all of these things. So education, you do your essay with AI and then the markers have to check whether there was an AI thing. So, you know, with employment, you do your job application with AI and then the employer sifts it through AI.
Public services, of course, are now smoothly using AI, but everyone is drafting their planning objections using AI, and they're overloading the system. And we've got drones, but you've got drones, and no one is feeling a lot safer. So I think there is a perpetual arms race with technology, which tends to get overlooked by the people that are trying to sell you a technology. Third point, the one area I think there will be unqualified good that comes from AI, really, in the long run, is science. I think we will lead longer, healthier lives because of this. But might that be in a sort of enshittified world? It may not. You might be around for longer, but not enjoying yourself as much. I don't know. And then my very final point is geopolitics. Who do you trust with this new ultra-powerful technology in their hands? Russia? China? The United States of America?
Okay, I think that's the perfect point to return control into your hands, because now we return back to our judges, which is our audience. So you now get to vote again as to who has convinced you the most. So don't just vote the same way you did first time. Obviously, if you hold the same opinion, vote the same way. But if your opinion has changed, then vote as you now feel. So hands up those of you who are in support of the proposition that yes, AI will secure humanity's future. Okay, okay. I'm not going to prejudge, but let's see. Hands up those who are in support of the proposition that no, AI will not secure humanity's future. Right. I would say that there is more people voting no than there was in the first poll. I therefore declare the winners are Judy and Hayton. So congratulations. Okay, so that brings the debate to a close. There's just one or two things to do. First of all, thank you from me to all of our speakers for this really excellent and lively debate that everyone really entered into full-hearted. And I hope that you all in the audience enjoyed it as much as I did from sitting here on this stage. It's also just to say, if you have missed any of the LSE Festival events, you can catch them on the LSE YouTube channel, where no doubt the AI will serve you a perfectly curated stream of LSE videos to watch. And then the last thing for me to do is to say, please again, show your appreciation and a round of applause for Michael, Stephanie, Judy and Hayton.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.